Hi, everyone. Welcome to Strangers from the Internet. I'm Angie.
And I'm Bethany.
And today we are going to be talking to you about what is basically my favorite film of all time. I'm not saying it's the best film, but it definitely ranks way up on my list of favorites. It kind of ties into our twist ending episodes as well.
Yep.
We mentioned it briefly how we couldn't possibly do it without doing a whole episode. So here we are, we're going to talk about Fight Club.
And I guess, do we want to start with the twist? Since that's where we...
Yes, I guess once again, you know, spoiler warning.
For a movie that's over 10 years old, I'm sorry, guys.
Right, exactly. I mean, I think... At this point in time...
If you haven't seen Fight Club, stop and go watch Fight Club.
Yeah.
Because it's ridiculous at this point.
Right. I mean, I think you probably it's probably all you know about Fight Club if you've never seen it is the twist at this point. I'm just guessing. But...
Well, and I'm going to be really honest, though, because 99, when Fight Club came out, was like... It was during high school, and without getting into long story too long to talk about, it was kind of a really difficult time. And so I didn't, like, catch a lot of, like, movies. Like, I think I caught The Matrix and that was, like, it. So I didn't watch Fight Club until a few years ago, and I already knew the twist back when I watched it when we first got Netflix.
Okay.
So
yeah, it had pretty much already gotten into the collective subconscious for you to know.
Yeah.
So, okay. So I'd be shocked if anyone out there doesn't know, but just in case, stop. You know, don't go any further if you don't want to know.
Yeah.
The twist is that the main character, Brad Pitt's character, Tyler Durden, is in the imagination of Edward Norton's character, who does not have a name. He is just the narrator. A lot of people call him Jack, and I believe that's how he was referred to in the script, based on those little lines, the I'm Jack's raging bile duct and so forth. But technically, he does not have a name.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he is a fictional construct that Edward Norton's character creates in order to create this new life for himself, and also to basically get Marla as his girlfriend.
According to when I read the book, the thing at the end, Chuck had written a epilogue.
Mm-hmm.
It was like from his point of view, and he said it was entirely about Marla. That was like the whole point.
Yeah, I can certainly see that.
Which he doesn't. Has a funny way of showing it, but that's what he says.
I think I think in the book it's a little bit clearer that it is about Marla. The movie does a wonderful job in that the first time you watch the movie, you think Marla is a bitch.
Oh yeah.
You can't stand her. Like, what, you know, she's dating Tyler and yet she keeps going and flirting with the narrator and you're like, what the hell is wrong with you, woman? And then
and then getting really pissed off at him when he's like, whatever.
Right.
Because that's how he's always been to her.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, what did you expect? He's always been like this.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't make sense until you realize, oh.
Right.
Oh, that's kind of fucked up.
Yeah, the second time you watch the film, you're like, oh my God, poor Marla, I'm so sorry.
Everything is already so fucked up, and now it's even more fucked up because he's like Jekyll and Hyde.
Yep.
So,
which in a lot of ways, like, I didn't even realize that until a couple months ago, but he totally is. That's kind of what he does. He creates this character to sort of explore this, not necessarily the darker side, but it's definitely, you know what I mean? And then it kind of goes out of control. It's definitely a Jekyll and Hyde deal in a lot of ways.
Well, the thing that's important to keep in mind, and I think a lot of people lose track of this as well. You know, Tyler Durden is a fictional construct of the narrator. He's the narrator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're not, like, separate. It's not like even a split personality. This is just his suppressed.
Yeah.
You know, and some of the suppressed stuff is bad. You know, because one of the things that's really clear in the book is that the reason that Tyler came to be is because the narrator didn't have the guts and didn't have the... Well, there's part of the thing that I come away from, both in the book and the movie, is that if there's any kind of lesson to be gleaned from this, is that doing what you think you should do according to everyone else is quite possibly the wrongest thing you could do.
Mm-hmm.
Part of why the narrator doesn't go for Marla is because he shouldn't. She's exactly the wrong kind of person he should ever go out with.
You mean like according to society?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. She's bottom of the spectrum, you know?
Mm-hmm.
She's not, you know, she's lying her way through these
therapy
sessions.
Yeah, now, but I
don't
guess...
Yeah.
The main thing is that it's like they meet doing the same exact thing. They're both lying, they're both, you know, they have slightly different reasons for being there, but they're both doing the same kind of thing. Which is why it's always, it's kind of almost strange to me, like, why wouldn't you immediately accept her, but...
Well, the reasoning he gives is because he needs it, and she's just doing it for fun, and he knows she's just doing it for fun, because he clearly knows it. But that's the reason he gives, is because he has an actual need, and she doesn't, and he doesn't know she has an actual need.
Yeah.
Or not. He just assumes because there's, like, part of him that's doing it for the same reason she's doing it. He's judging her for what he's doing.
Yeah, I guess that's what it is. He's kind of ashamed of himself at that point.
Yeah, but he goes, oh, but if I stop doing this, then yeah. I won't be able to sleep.
Right.
And so he has to blame her for it because he's constructed this need for it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of it. But the other part of it is she's just absolutely, like, she doesn't work in an office.
What does she do? Do they ever say if she has a job?
Steal clothes. And.
She steals the Meals on Wheels from her neighbors.
She steals Meals on Wheels.
So maybe she doesn't work. Maybe she just kind of, I don't remember now.
She's pretty much exactly the wrong kind of person he should be interested in. Except for this one thing that they have in common,
mm-hmm.
that he immediately rejects her for. You know.
Yeah. So he slowly changes himself, even though he doesn't stop working, but he definitely goes and he lives in a very different environment and starts doing very different things, all as a kind of way to be more like her and be able to belong with her.
Well, and that first, especially, it's a bit clearer in the movie, I think, than in the book, but that first section of the movie where he's talking about, you know, living in the file cabinet, and mm-hmm. he's talking about how everything's complete, I won't have to buy a sofa again, that's all about what you should have.
Oh, yeah, the importance that society puts on material possessions is definitely a huge current of the film, and I think is part of... one of the large reasons why this has become a cult classic now is that I think our generation in particular, I don't know about probably also Generation X, and I don't know about the people behind us, but that's definitely kind of how we feel. We no longer put this importance on material possessions the way that the older generations do.
Yeah, well, there's this, I think the material possession thing falls under, like, this larger umbrella.
Oh, yeah, it's all the same, right?
Yeah, it's all part of the same thing where, you know, your house is incomplete if you don't have a sofa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or if you don't have X and Y and Z, you're not worthy of everything else or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about doing what you think... you should be doing according to everyone else as according to doing what you think you should be doing according to yourself.
Right.
You know, and that ties like all sorts of shit into it. It ties in the material possessions thing and abstracting it. You can get into like gender identity and all sorts of other things. Fight Club obviously doesn't yes. really explore that. It's a very masculine movie.
Right. Well, I think it's being, I guess, purposely told from the male perspective. That's kind of the one thing that always kind of bugs me is like, where do the women fit in this revolution? Because you can't continue the species
yeah.
without them.
I think in this case, it's more a sort of casual kind of sexism thing where you get into, and you'll see it a lot in like fiction where you get like the Smurfette syndrome where there's all these guys and then there's the one girl.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, all these guys have all these different traits. You know, there's the brainy Smurf, and then there's the artistic Smurf, and then there's the vain Smurf, and there's one girl, and her personality is girl. That's just,
right.
There's this kind of setting in fiction where that happens a lot, and I don't think even people are thinking about it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, which is why I say it's casual and not, like, deliberate.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of lines in the movie that I don't think actually come from the book, which makes it a little more deliberate in the movie.
Exactly,
but
yeah, that's what I was gonna say. Like, I think in the book, I want to say that there is at least some reference to not necessarily the women being in the fight clubs, but probably like when it gets to Project Mayhem era, like there are women in the service jobs.
Yeah.
So that it's not quite as exclusive there, but in the movie, because really, even the book doesn't, all that stuff about, you know, don't talk to us, don't talk to her about us, and then, you know, we have to talk about how she's compromised our goals, and, like, suddenly it becomes, like, we have to kill Marla. Like, that's not in the book at all.
Yeah.
So you're right in that the movie does sort of force it into that male area even more so.
Yeah.
With that,
you know,
kind of
stuff. I think if we were looking at Fight Club from a point of view of having seen it actually happen, I think what I'm trying to say is if I think something like Fight Club actually happened in sort of a small area, maybe it didn't get to the Project Mayhem point, but we had these fight clubs start and then it kind of petered out or something.
Yeah.
You would see a lot more girls in Fight Club than.
Which it has happened in real life.
Yeah, it has.
Every now and then they I hear that on the news. I don't know whatever becomes of it or anything. But and of course, sadly, the idea is that the same thing happens in real life that sort of happens in the books, is that people start looking at it like it's a gang.
Yeah.
And the problem with that is that gangs go out and actively hurt other groups. Whereas the whole idea of Fight Club isn't about, I want to beat the shit out of somebody. It's about, I want to get the shit beaten out of me. I want to feel pain because I've been in this, like, little comfortable zone all my life. And I want to kind of get out of that and feel pain and survive.
Yeah, it's about the numbness of being, too.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well,
and I've had an office job that kind of put me in a state where I could see being being drawn to that kind of thing. You know, I had this horrible job where I worked for a phone company and I was answering phone calls and it was, I would work and then I would go home and I would dream about working and it was like the worst day I'd had, but not like dragons chasing me through the call center or anything. It was just like a really bad work day. And then I'd wake up and go to work and it drove me, like closest to actually really insane I've ever been, to the point where I would, like, stand outside of work. I wasn't sure if I was asleep or awake at this point. I'd be like, you know, if I ran into traffic, I would learn the answer to that question. And it wasn't suicide. I just wanted to wake up, and I wasn't sure if I was asleep. It was terrible. It was the worst thing.
Yeah. Well, I know for me, I mean, I worked the office job, and it's there's definitely that, like I said, the whole thing he's talking about with, you know, when you tell people, oh, I got a new sofa, they're happy for you. Like, that's something to be excited about, you know? And it's like, when you're getting married, when you're having kids, it's like, it's all, oh, you bought a house? That's awesome. Oh, you're getting a new car? It's all about possessions and these so-called achievements, what I would say. And it's like, oh, I mean, I don't want to get in a fight. I guess because I'm a natural person who just avoids conflict in all forms, so that's not necessarily what I would go toward, but I certainly understand the dissatisfaction.
Well, I definitely, my job sucked. So I definitely, like, there was that one point, I wouldn't have cared if I lost or won or whatever. It wasn't about that. It was about just getting, interrupting this dream wake cycle that did never seem to end, but it was kind of a nightmare of a situation. So I definitely see the appeal of the Fight Club, and I really do think I would have gone for it at the time. We didn't get into a whole lot of the little stuff that, oh, I got a new soap or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. You know, I guess, like I said, those scenes in the office and, like, the stuff that he's talking about with his condo, like, It's almost funny to me, because it's like, I mean, I saw that movie when I was a senior in high school, and it meant so much to me, and yet here I am. Didn't I take anything from that? But, no, I mean, I don't know, it's kind of like, it means even more to me now. I understand it now.
Yeah. Well, his job is also pretty soul-sucking.
Yeah, no kidding. His job was evil.
His job was evil.
I mean, there's no doubt about that. So, I mean, yeah, you could certainly, that's the kind of thing you would want to escape. There's no doubt about that. I guess, like I said, to me, I don't know, I have a hard time wrapping my head around the idea of violence. I understand the mayhem to an extent.
Well, you know what it is, though, is the narrator doesn't have anything else. You know, he doesn't have friends who look in on him, you know, who are worried about him until he gets in with Tyler Durden and right. Merlin. There are people in his life all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have friends. He doesn't have any kind of social life at all.
Except for the support groups, basically.
Yeah, but he's lying to all of them.
Yeah.
Does he write fake names on his name tag, or does he even bother?
Well, he definitely does in the movie. I don't know if they confirm that if he does that in the books or not, but yeah, like he has a different name for pretty much every single club.
Yeah, none of them are his names.
Right.
So these are, you know, that's not a social life, that's his...
It's a sleep aid.
Yeah. You know, that's not a social life, that's a... That's like watching something before you go to bed.
Yeah. Or almost a form of therapy in a way, except that he's not moving on from it because he's not...
He's not actually participating in therapy.
Right. He's not being honest enough with himself about what's going on, so... It's just like a temporary relief,
yeah.
I guess.
Well, it lets him cry it out, and that's what he needs to go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And he can only do that in the self-help groups.
Yeah.
The support groups where people are dying, which is, I suppose, a little alarming.
Well, I think that's kind of one of the... Because, he starts off with these support groups where he's surrounded by death, and Tyler really kind of teaches him, well, no, don't just be surrounded by death and sort of like, you know, these people who they're dying, but they do all these things to like make peace with it. He says, no, like face it head on kind of deal. Like, you know, look at it and really just realize that one day you're going to die and accept it. Don't try, oh, I can use meditation to fight it, or, you know what I mean? Like that kind of stuff.
Well, and one of the things that the narrator is also doing is, even though he's surrounding himself with these people who are dying, he's not going to die. He's got that same, it's especially prevalent in teenage kids, where you feel...
Invincible, yeah.
Yeah, you know, oh, that this horrible thing that's happening to all these people isn't actually going to happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Tyler Durden basically is a threat, and it's he becomes a threat, and it's the only threat that really the narrator's ever faced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, dealing with the people at the office is just, meh, whatever.
Yeah.
And it becomes easier as time goes on, because he doesn't give a shit. It's a lot easier to deal with people if you don't give a shit,
Oh, which, I was watching the commentary. There's a commentary with Chuck Palahniuk and the screenwriter on there. And Chuck said that his inspiration for the whole thing was he went camping and he got into a fight with some people while he was out there. And so he came back to work with two black eyes and no one wanted to ask him what was wrong, what happened. So he said for about 3 months, as these like big black eyes slowly faded away, people would just look at his chest. Like no one would make eye contact with him. No one wanted to deal with this very real, you know, brutal kind of thing, which is just so, that's so true. Like, that's so how people are. I don't know.
Oh, wow. Yeah, no, because if you ask that question, then you have to deal with the answer.
Exactly. Like, I mean, you know, because you know how it is. Like, you run to me and say, oh, how you doing? Oh, fine. Like, nobody wants to hear the real...
Yeah, how are you doing? Oh, man, my dog just died.
Yeah.
Yeah, nobody wants that.
Right, because then it's like, oh, I'm sorry. Oh, that's terrible. You know.
I've got to run.
Exactly.
We'll catch up later, that kind of thing. No, nobody mm-hmm. wants to hear how you're really doing. How are you doing is just that's a call and response.
Yes.
Oh, I'm fine. No. And so nobody can go, hey, what happened to your eyes? Because the answer might be, well, I got into a drunken fight with my dad, who's an asshole.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Or something really depressing.
Mm-hmm.
Not his, which is fairly, I mean, you know, got into a fight while camping. That's not...
Yeah, it sounded like... Well, I don't know if you'd say he started it. He said, like, they were, like, blaring music out in the middle of these campgrounds, and he was trying to tell them to turn it down, and it turned into a fight. That's interesting.
Well, you know, if they're out camping, there's probably drinking going on.
Right.
So... That can evolve pretty quickly when there are people who have alcohol. Or some people are just fighty. I mean, it happens. It's just, yeah. You know.
But anyway, I thought that was really interesting that that was sort of the inspiration for the whole idea. That sort of juxtaposition of being in an office and then being totally bruised up.
Yeah, and having nobody, like...
Right.
Nobody says thing. Nobody wants to know.
Yep.
Oh, that calls back to him not, like, because he doesn't have any real friends in the office then.
There's, in the book, he kind of says that he thought of his boss as his dad or father figure. But yeah, he really doesn't have any friends. And I think it comes from the fact that he's always traveling, too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's never really in the office because he's always going back and forth and back and forth between these sites where the accidents have happened. So he's got to, you know, go and do the inspections and all. So, yeah, he probably doesn't get close to anyone because he's always on a plane. That's why he's got his single-serving friends.
Yes.
You know, and you can't get close to people like that, so.
No. Yeah. Well, I mean, I have worked with people who I am, like, close friends with, and they are the people who will be like, hey, what happened? Are you okay?
Right, yeah.
That's what happens when you have these really superficial relationships with people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're polite to the people in the office because you work with them and for no other reason, which I think is coming back. It all ties into the society thing.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
The societal standards for...
And so that's kind of why, yeah, it's sort of why he creates... I mean, I don't know if he knew for sure that other people would latch on to it the way they did. He obviously just started beating the crap out of himself and other people noticed and said, hey, can I beat you up instead? Yeah. Like, it's funny because that you never really see that happen in the book or the movie, but, like, but you know, how does that start? Like, they just see somebody, like, literally beating the crap out of themselves. I don't know. Like, people had to know from the very beginning that this guy's kind of nuts, and yet they all follow him. You know what I mean?
Tyler Durden in and of himself is sort of... nutty anyway, if you add in the both of them are being the same person, I think it's pretty clear from the get-go.
Oh, yeah.
But
I guess, like I said, to me, it's just interesting that it's like people follow him, you know? And he becomes almost like a legend with all of his quirkiness.
Well, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, I maybe they just assumed that if the guy was beating the crap out of himself, he knew what he was doing. I mean, I don't know how that works, but Tyler Durden is very charismatic, though.
Oh, yes.
And complete opposite of the narrator who has, like, no game.
He's clever. That's about all he's got.
Yeah. He's clever, but...
Well, I think, you know, it's like, once again, that whole idea that Tyler is sort of this idealized version of himself in a lot of ways. He's...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the fact that they cast Brad Pitt, who is basically the hottest guy as far as, like, people were concerned as far as movies, was just absolute perfect casting. I mean, I think the fact that him and Fincher were already getting along good because of Seven and all also helped it work. But, you know, it's like, of course you've got Brad Pitt in that role because... He's supposed to be perfect. He's supposed to be everything that you would want to be.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and then, of course, they put him in that crazy clothing.
Oh, yeah, I love his clothing in the movie. Uh-huh. It's always great.
Yeah, some of those shirts, it's like, oh, man, I want that. Like, where do you find that kind of stuff? It's great.
Well, there's a jacket or two, I swear. It looks like, I don't know what they slaughtered for it, but...
I think in one of the commentaries they called it the buffalo coat. You're talking about the one toward the end?
Yeah.
The big furry thing. Yeah, he was calling it a buffalo coat. I don't know if it's meant to actually look like buffalo fur or not, but yeah.
Well, it's completely off the wall. It's all to contrast Norton's very bland business attire that he wears basically the whole time.
Yeah.
He never spices it up. I don't even think he gets any interesting ties.
No.
So it's all about this contrast between Brad Pitt, who wears what the fuck he wants,
mm-hmm.
and Edward Norton, who wears the suit that he's supposed to wear for work all the time.
Right. It's not with the clothing, but it's interesting with the rest of the movie, like the way it kind of flows. It's like when we start off, Edward Norton says, "No, I don't smoke." And then toward the end of it, he's smoking cigarettes all the time, and Brad Pitt isn't anymore.
Yeah, I did notice that.
And his he doesn't change clothing, but his outfits get messier and messier.
They do, and a little more bloodstained.
Right. And another fun thing, and I'm pretty sure, but if I could, from when I've seen it so many times, only one of them will be horribly beaten up at one time.
Oh, yeah.
And it's the attention to detail that they've put into the twist and making it work. Because that's what it is. Sometimes you'll see one of them fighting and the other one will just be standing there like immaculate watching it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how it goes. And even like after the fights are over with, like one of them will be bruised and the other one is perfectly clean. There's so many hints. And that's why it's like, because it knocked me off my ass when it was revealed. You know, it was like, I had no idea. But then you go back and you watch, and there are so many hints.
Yeah, it's not one of those things that comes out and, like feels like a cheat.
No. There aren't any points in the movie where you go, well, if they're the same person, then how does this work? Like, they're really, you can't, it's almost flawless. It really is.
Yeah, and when I watched it the first time, I knew about the ending ahead of time, so I was watching for all those little things.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when you get the first one with Marla. That first scene with Marla.
Uh-huh.
Is really where you're like, huh.
I like
because he's been dreaming about boning her.
Yeah. And well, but that's the thing, it's like, you could, when you first watch, you could say, oh, well, you know, he heard it going on in the other room all night. So it makes sense that he could dream about it.
Oh, yeah, you can excuse you know? It out of the way.
And yeah, and like you said, you know, you're angry at her. And then, but then, yeah, like later, like you're like, oh my God, of course. You know, it's like the only scene that kind of throws me off, and it's not that it's inaccurate, I just don't know how to dissect it, is when they're in the car together and with the two guys in the back seat. I never can tell just how much of the conversation the guys in the back are able to hear.
Yeah, that's what I wonder, too, and that's one of the things I wonder about the movie is how many of those conversations are out loud and how many of those conversations are going on in their head.
Mm-hmm. Because not too many of the conversations they have involve other people around, for the most part.
Well, there's times when they're, like, especially towards the end when they're, like, walking by all the Project Mayhem recruits.
Yeah.
And they're talking to each other, and it's like, and you're kind of wondering who's in charge of the body at that moment.
Yeah.
Like, and I want, you know, I wish I'd thought of this before, because I wonder if who's in charge of the body correlates to who's battered up, who's, like, bruised and bloody.
Not necessarily, because I think when Brad Pitt gives some of his speeches, obviously he's in control.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes he does still look, like, flawless, essentially.
Mm.
But, I mean, I think that is kind of, like, part of it, like, because when they're driving and you see the guys in the back give each other looks, like, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah.
So it's entirely possible that he could be saying the entire conversation aloud back and forth between himself. Because I noticed, like, I mean, it is, you'll notice, like, you know, he'd be like, I want to be involved. I want to know certain things first. And they answer, like, you know, the first rule of Project Mayhem is you do not ask questions.
Yeah.
And it's like, so they're obviously hearing some of it. But it's just, yeah, like, that's the only thing where it's kind of like, I mean, can you just imagine being in the back seat and hearing someone, like, yell at themselves?
Yell at themselves and have that whole conversation with themselves.
Right.
Well, we talked about this before, though, because it's clear from the beginning that Tyler Durden is completely unfocused, is not well.
Oh, yeah, he's not, he's an id, essentially.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, he's got some really good ideas, but he's also got some really bad ideas.
And he has no capability to tell which one is which.
Right.
He's just, he's going to do everything he wants to do.
Mm-hmm. But it really, it's, I don't know, it's kind of one of the things, like, I think in the movie, like, in the book, Tyler actually kills people. He kills a politician who gets in their way, or he's a politician or policeman, and then he also actively kills the narrator's boss.
He does.
Which I think is, it becomes a little bit more clear in the book how, like, that was basically because the boss was, like, his father figure. Tyler needed to kill him in order to make sure that he would be the sole influence.
Yeah, well, the movie makes the Tyler Durden character a little more ambiguous than the book makes him.
Right.
Because in the book, towards the end, he needs to be stopped. Clearly, there's something going on. But in the movie, it's a little more, you know, there's nobody who's going to get harmed in the buildings that go down.
And, right, yeah, they evacuate them. And even, like, I mean, like, in the car scene, it's like, that's pretty reckless. You could really die. You know, he could have killed everyone in that car, but yet it almost feels like the narrator needed to go through that because of his job.
Yeah.
And he really needed to see, you know, I've been making these people statistics and now I'm one of the statistics.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. So it's like, yeah, that was nuts, but maybe it was kind of necessary, you know, and the idea that he wants to destroy these buildings, which, you know, I mean, I hate to burst the bubble, but that totally wouldn't work. There's backup systems off-site. Nobody's debt's going away just because you blow up the buildings. But,
no.
You know, but that idea of erasing the debt, that would be a pretty nice thing.
Yeah.
You know, the only people that are really going to hurt from that are corporations, and fuck corporations.
Yeah, no, that's you know? Yeah, again, the character. Well, also in the book, he starts off from the beginning. And he's not like stealing. Like, I think he does it later, but he doesn't start off making soap from stolen liposuction fat. He starts off using Marla's mother's fat that she was saving.
I can understand why they didn't do it in the movie.
Yeah, because I don't know how you would frame that.
That's such a funny scene in the book. Because what happens is, Marla has been having her mother ship fat to her to keep in the freezer in case, like, she wants to get, like, her lips plumped or whatever. And so Tyler starts using it to make the soap. So Marla finds out about it, because it's not in the freezer anymore, and she gets pissed. And I guess there must be some fat still lying around. She, like, chases him around the house, and some of the fat breaks open, and they end up slipping and sliding all over the house on the fat.
Yeah, it's like this real slapstick.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, I can understand why they wouldn't do it, but oh my, can you just imagine seeing that? Like, that would have been hysterical.
Yeah, that would have.
I mean, it's pretty funny what they do in the movie, too, where, like, he's throwing it over the fence, and it gets torn, and you're like, oh, and he's, like, trying to catch it in his hands, like, why? It's like, what good is it going to do, you know, but yet he reaches up to catch it anyway. It's like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a good scene, but I do kind of wish they figured out some way to put the
right
Marla scene in, just because I kind of wanted more Marla in that movie. But
yeah, Helena Bonham Carter is great, too.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like I said, you know, between the fact that your perspective of her changes and everything, she just really, it would be very easy to have a kind of, like, bland performance, I guess, for that, but she really holds it off where, like, she incites emotion in you in different ways, and that's not an easy thing to pull off, you know?
Yeah, well, and it's funny how much nuance is in that performance, because, again, you'd see it the one time, and you're like, man, she's kind of a bitch, and then you really like her paying attention, and you're like, no, she's really kind of stung and angry, and she's hurting.
Yeah.
And you just, it works both ways somehow, and I think just props to her for that, because it's a really great performance.
Yeah. It's like, it that's kind of the interesting thing about both the book and the movie is that it's like, yeah, it does really kind of have that male blinders or whatever you want to put on it, but yet Marla is the most put together character of both of them. You know, she's the one that already has it figured out and knows where she's going with it. So,
well, and the point of the book, and less so I think in the movie, because they do kind of change it, the tone a little for the movie. But the point of the book was so he could be in the same place that Marla is in.
Yeah.
So they, because I think that was part of the thing, is he could only be with Marla if he was in the same place she was in, really. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to remember what all he said in the prologue, the epilogue, whatever it was. I don't have my book on.
You must have a different edition or something, I guess.
Well, I bought it, I bought it, like, not that long ago, so.
Yeah, I mean, because there's the epilogue of the actual story itself.
Yeah.
Where basically what happens is after everything happens, which the building doesn't blow up in the book.
Yeah.
Because the idea is that Tyler set the bomb to blow up in this building, but because he used a method that the narrator never gets right, it doesn't go off. It's kind of like, it's Tyler's been putting so much influence on the narrator up to that point, and then suddenly the narrator kind of influenced Tyler to screw it up in a way.
Yeah.
And the whole point was actually for the building to blow up and fall on the history museum. Because he wanted to destroy history in the book. He didn't want to just destroy the debt record.
Yeah, and also he was going to, I mean, the point also was to kill himself, to...
Yeah, to kind of become a martyr for the cause.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because he knew if he wiped himself out, that would be the best way to get everything to carry on.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to it just eventually kind of losing momentum.
Right. So it obviously, like I said, it doesn't go off, and he ends up put in an asylum, essentially. Like, I think he calls it, he claims he's dead, but it's obvious from everything he's saying that he's in an asylum. And, you know, like, he says, like, Marla comes and visits him and tells him to come back to the living and that kind of stuff. But he can't do it because every now and then someone will come in his room and tell him, everything's going according to plan, sir, and stuff like that. So he knows that the movement is still going on.
Yeah. Well, I have to tell you, I did not get that epilogue. I did not read any of that.
Really?
Yeah. It just ends with the explosion not going off and...
Huh.
And I wonder, I think my version of the book came out after the movie.
Okay.
Almost had to have been, they removed the epilogue so that it wasn't, I mean, I don't know, but
well,
it was, the epilogue I got was, like, written by Chuck, and it was about the book.
Okay.
But I didn't get any, because you were talking about that on AIM the other day, and I was like, what is she talking about?
Right, that's interesting. So, apparently, somewhere along the way, I would assume that would mean that he decided to take it out. Maybe he wanted to leave it more ambiguous?
Maybe he was just because, I mean, I have no clue, but let me see.
Because I wouldn't think it would be, I mean, that's, you know, the fact that a book ends differently than the movie, that's typical. I mean, that's A Clockwork Orange. Though part of that was because the original American edition of Clockwork Orange didn't have the epilogue. So when Kubrick made the film, he didn't realize there was more to it. You know, so I mean, and usually an epilogue is really, it's a book type thing. It's not something you're going to include in a film. Because you don't want, depending on what happens, you usually want to end on the climax and the resolution. You don't want to, like, it's the kind of stuff you, in a movie world you would save for the sequel, sort of, you know? So that's interesting that they've now cut it out of the book.
Huh. Again, I don't think I read it that fast. I mean...
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, see, if you're talking about, like, a sort of, almost like an afterword at the end, I definitely don't have that. Now, that might be because it's, like, sometimes a 10-year anniversary edition, they add more to it.
It may have been. I don't know if that came... God.
But I would think you would... Part. You would have to remember.
It's entirely possible I just missed the ending of the book. I don't have any clue what happened.
I mean, I would think you would have to remember that whole thing with the asylum and...
You would think, but... It's entirely possible
I guess we need to ask our readers, you know, if you're out there and you have a copy of the book, tell us if yours has that epilogue with the narrator in the asylum or not. Because I can't ask you now, because I'm curious... I know for, like, the longest time, when I had first read the book and I read that epilogue, I thought, oh, Tyler's not really dead.
Mm-hmm.
And, but it's kind of like, you could sort of, I guess it's open to interpretation. You could either take that to mean Tyler isn't really dead, and when he goes to sleep in the asylum, Tyler is once again taking over, talking to the orderlies, etc., etc. Or you could take it as Tyler is gone, but the movement is still out there. He succeeded in making himself the martyr, so to speak.
Yeah.
And so the narrator is staying committed because either he's hoping it'll die off, or he doesn't want to be held responsible for anything that does happen from that point onward. You know?
You know, it's possible. I have no clue. I don't have, again, I'm not at home. I don't have my book with me. I can't, like, open it up and just see if maybe I fail at reading.
Well, let me ask you this. What was in that kind of afterward? Like, what else did he say?
Well, he was talking about, it was Chuck, and he was talking about how, like, everywhere he went to a haunted house, and someone was like, the first rule of haunted house is we don't talk about the haunted house. And he was like, no, you know, I wrote that book, right? And how everybody calls it, like, an ode to, I'm trying to remember how he phrased it, an ode to bringing down capitalism and, like, all the stuff we've talked about here. And he says, nobody calls it a romance.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And he talks a little bit about, you know, nobody expected, you know, me to write a book like this.
They didn't think he was that subversive kind of thing?
Yeah.
Okay. Because it...
Well, he's from Portland, and I think he was something really, like, teacher or something.
Well, I know, like, so just listening to the commentary, he worked in an office, obviously. That was part of the inspiration. He also worked at a hospice for a while.
Yeah.
And he was a driver, and that's how he got familiar with the support groups, because he would drive the hospice patients to their support groups, and then he would have to stay to bring them back, so he got to witness a lot of these things.
Yeah, he was a journalist, that's what I was thinking.
Okay, okay.
He was also a diesel mechanic.
See, he's been a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
Which usually does make a good writer, because that, you know, you always take your experiences and put them into your writing, so he's got plenty of experiences to choose from.
Yeah, but yeah, he was just basically talking about, like, his experiences with it and how he was kind of, seemed like unassuming kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you mentioned the story you were telling about the black eyes.
Okay.
It was kind of an afterthought. I wish I had brought my book. I wasn't thinking.
That's okay.
I don't see anything. I mean, I know it might be wrong, but I don't see anything about in Wikipedia about the ending that afterward being removed. So It may just be that
you read it too fast?
Read it too fast, or, well, that was when a whole bunch of other stuff came up, so it might just be that.
Mm-hmm. You were distracted, yeah. So, the another interesting thing in the book, and I remember, because I know you had said you couldn't remember that either, it's Marla actually does have lumps in her breast.
Yeah.
It sounds like she just doesn't have enough money to go to a doctor and actually get it looked at. But basically, she's got two different lumps in her breast. So she may actually have cancer, which I think is kind of interesting.
Yeah, and it kind of puts a different spin on why she's attending all these cancer support groups.
Right. And then there's also that, and I can understand why they took this out, because it kind of goes nowhere. But it's just, like, in order to calm her down, he tells her about how he went to a doctor, and he's got a birthmark on his foot, but it resembled some kind of, like, rare type of cancer, so that, like, all these doctors, like, rushed into the room and took pictures of his foot, and they were all excited and asking him about it, and then once they realized it was just a birthmark, like, they all just, like, left.
Yeah.
And so he was, like basically, yeah, like, for, like, 10 minutes, he was dying. And then all of a sudden, it was like, oh, no, it's nothing, never mind.
Yeah.
So it's a fun little story kind of thing, but yet it really, it doesn't, neither one of those stories go anywhere. So, like, they kept the scene about him checking her lump, because it adds to their relationship, which, once again, it does highlight that this is essentially a romance.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. I mean, it's interesting, because usually what happens when you make a movie, they add romance elements in order to, you know, make it more Hollywood.
Yeah. But
in this book, a lot, in some ways, they almost took away from the romance.
They did. They took away a lot from the romance. And again, they kind of reduced, I think they reduced a lot of Marla's screen time, as it were. I think in the book she had a lot more. A
little bit more involvement.
Yeah, development.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
What did you think about in the book where she shows up with all the support group people to try and save him?
I thought that was a really neat moment.
It's like, it has the danger of being really hokey, you know what I mean? Because it's all like, oh, we love you! But yet, I think it sort of kind of shows that even though he was lying in the support groups, he actually sort of was building relationships. That was the closest thing he had to friendship at that point.
And that maybe those were more real than what he had with the Project Mayhem and everybody like that.
Exactly.
Marla was the realest thing in his life, and the support groups were maybe like second to her. That was like my favorite moment, I think, in the book, was when she showed up with the support group people. And maybe I'm just a sucker for things like that, but...
Well, I think it's especially when you watch the movie first, it's really quite surprising. Because, you know, in the movie, they bring up when Chloe dies, you know, and then it's kind of, that's sort of the end of it. But then in the movie, he kind of brings it, I mean, in the book, rather, he brings it full circle.
He does.
And it does, like, yeah, it's like, I think, I don't know, if they could have, depending on how they would have executed it in the movie, it could have looked kind of silly. But yeah, it does, it surprisingly works in the book, it really does.
Yeah, and I think that was probably one of Marla's best moments, too, was, like, motivating all these people to get there.
Yeah, that's true.
Even though it was off-screen.
Right, it's almost like she kind of became her own little leader, in a way.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, and they said, well, you know, we're saying he was lying. He never said anything showing up to these support groups.
Right, yeah. Cause
that was one of the things he said in the beginning. They always assume it's worse if you don't say anything, and if you say something, then you're going to have to know what you're talking about. So he never even talks.
Right.
Maybe like small talk, but he never actually talks about what might be wrong with him. So
yeah.
Lying by omission more than...
Mm-hmm. And even like when, I don't know if it happens in the book, but in the movie where he runs into Bob again.
Mm-hmm.
And like they'll say, oh, we thought you were dead.
Yeah.
Because it's like, yeah, he stopped going to the support group. So naturally you would kind of, when you're talking about a cancer support group, you would think
they assume
that,
he passed away.
Right. Exactly. So, yeah, it's, he didn't technically lie to them. He felt like he was lying to himself, I think.
Yeah.
Because he knew he was kind of committing this deception, but he obviously formed some kind of bond with them through it all. So, yeah, that was like the biggest surprise for me when I read the book for the first time.
Yeah, no, again, that was, because they don't really go there in the movie, so it was really nice to read that in the book when I read the book. I bought the book so we could talk about it, and I read it like almost immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So, and things have come up since, so that's why, like, I'm sitting here going, I do remember some of this stuff, right?
So,
because prepared I am.
Even having only read it once, would you say you prefer the book or the movie?
See.
Or do you feel like you need to read it a few more times to really absorb it?
No, I love the book, and I'm going to read it again. The thing is they're kind of different entities to me. You know, the movie changes itself just enough that it takes on, like, a different tone entirely for me. So I don't know that I even would, like... But I have this thing about books and movies anyway, where I always consider the film version of something to be a different canon than the book version of something.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I consider them to be, like, alternate universe kind of things. But, I mean, because I love the visual style of the movie. It's very appealing to me.
Oh, yeah.
But the book is a really easy read.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it goes really fast, and it has a lot of... There's a really great verbal style that matches the visual style, so I don't know that I could choose one. Man, I don't know. Maybe the book edges in for me just because I love Marla. And I think she shows up a little more in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But I do love Helena Bonham Carter. I can't. I love them too much.
I think because it's like they share the same themes.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. But you're right, it's like it's definitely alternate universes because of the way they both kind of end up. And I think that they both suit their mediums so well.
Yeah, that's
that it's like you... yeah, the changes that are made when they adapted it into a film, just that they're all the right kind of changes you would make. They rearranged some things, you know. They kept the narration, which is great, because I really don't think you could do that movie without narration.
And brave, because often narration just winds up terrible.
Exactly.
So it was a really brave choice, and they pulled it off.
Oh, it's
beautifully.
It makes it like a 2.5-hour music video to me. When you combine his style of narration with the Dust Brothers soundtrack, it's almost like a really long song in a lot of ways, is the way I almost look at that. Because it's just, oh, it's gorgeous the way it, and Fincher's, like, camera movements and cuts. It's a music video.
And the visual style of the movie really matches the written style.
Yes, yes.
They really, if you have seen the movie and you haven't seen the book and you go and read the book, it's going to feel really familiar to you because they really match the styles very well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just possibly the most perfect book-movie combo.
Right. Like, I mean, it's rare that Hollywood gets a book and really, truly understands what it's about and how it should be treated. And I think that's one of the reasons why this movie ranks so high for me, is because it's such an obvious understanding of the source material.
Oh, yeah.
It just works so well.
Oh, it was... Yeah, I don't think you could get... I can't think of any more beautifully executed book movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like they adapted this book into a movie.
Right.
It almost always, you know, you have to make changes for the visual medium and you almost always lose something in translation.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow in this film, they didn't.
Yeah.
And it, maybe it's due to the brevity of the book.
It probably
possibly
helps, yeah.
Because of all the thought process that they just leave in. They don't,
mm-hmm.
they don't take any of that out. They leave in the narration and stuff, which is the only way the film could possibly have worked.
Right.
But I can't think of, off the top of my head, a book that's been adapted to a movie that...
So well, yeah.
That got the book so perfectly.
Mm-hmm. And even,
so.
I mean, they even marketed it properly. I don't know how familiar, because you said you didn't watch the movie until quite a while later.
Yeah.
They made a catalog, like a shopping catalog, that was basically like... They had the ring that Marla wears when he confronts her at the support groups for the first time. It's like a big, gaudy, it's got like a flower, and it's one of those that opens.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, it's like the Fight Club Coke ring. When you're going out on the town and you just can't wait and you need that extra hit, it's like, it's played straight, but it's like all this really absurd. They include, like, scans of it on the, at least the original pressing of the DVD. I don't know if the more recent ones have it. But it's so great, and, like, Tyler's jacket, and even, like, the narrator's, like, business suits for, like, you know, oh, when you're, after you've been out all night partying, and you've got to go to the office the next day. This is, it's, like, it's such a great, because they could, I mean, so many movies, like The Princess Bride, for instance. It's
yes.
not your normal movie. And they tried so hard to sell it as something else in the promotional materials.
If you ever get a chance,
mm-hmm.
audience at large, to go watch The Princess Bride, the preview, the trailer for it, do it.
Yeah.
Because it is the most god-awful trailer.
It is. You know, and they could have so easily done that with Fight Club. They could have, like, so easily, like, tried to make it look like ultra macho, you know, fight action thriller, or, you know. But they didn't. They kept it mysterious. They kept it absurd.
Yes.
They did. Have you ever seen it's the theater, what do they call them? Like, before a movie starts, where they tell you where the exits are and that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
They did, Edward Norton did one and Brad Pitt did one. And it's like, he's like, you know, saying the excerpts of this, if the fire, please proceed in an orderly fashion, please no drinking, talking, smoking, you know. And no one can touch you in your bathing suit area. Like, or like, are the Brad Pitt one, like he goes through the whole spiel and then he kind of stops and he goes, did you know urine is sterile? You can drink it. Like, just totally straight. It's like so... great. It's like, it kind of matches the Project Mayhem billboards and stuff, you know? It's like, it's just such...
Captures the feel of the movie.
Yes, yes. Oh, it's... Oh. So they really... I mean, the whole process, they just... It's like a perfect snapshot in time that they actually executed something correctly, and you never get that.
You never get that. Well, you know, I will say that the second Batman movie, the second Nolan Batman movie, did some of that, because they had the arcs where they, like, sent people cakes and stuff.
Mm. Yeah.
Which I think... I think a lot of that kind of stuff probably owes itself to things like Fight Club, where they started doing really interesting things with the advertising.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think you can get much closer to being exactly what it should have been, as far as adapting it to a movie, keeping all of the spirit of the book almost entirely.
Right.
And it lost a little bit of the romantic.
But I think it's kind of a sort of... It's once again, it's like it all kind of, because you said the book is so fast.
The book is really fast. And the other thing is if you, there's something called the death of the author, which means that what the author meant to do with the book doesn't necessarily have anything to do with how the book should be interpreted. You know, while Chuck says he meant, you know, he said something about a romance, the romantic elements, even in the book, are not all there. I mean, you get them in kind of a, you know, flashbacks. And, you know, if you know they're there, you can go through and pick them out. But it's not all...
It's definitely subtle romance. It's not a romance novel or anything.
It's not, you know. It's not... The novel isn't about the romance. The character undergoes this change.
Yeah.
Because he wants to... Because of Marla. But that's not what the story is about.
No.
If that makes any sense.
Right.
You know, the story is about the change.
Mm-hmm.
Not who he's making the change for. So... You know, them dropping romantic elements for the film just makes the film a little bit neater to make. And I just don't think you can get...
Though I do think that, and you know, it's subtle, just like the book is subtle, but that moment at the end where they hold hands...
Yeah, that was nice.
It's so sweet.
I do love the film ending. I really do.
Yeah. And I've always, like, I'm like, what does the M stand for? Because don't pretend like it's not an M.
Yeah.
They make an M. So what, that's like one of the answers I've never, I guess maybe they're just being silly and messing with you, but I don't know. It's like, yeah, I've always, but it is, it, they, I guess they frame each other so well, and yeah, the explosions going off. It's such a great ending. And of course the Pixie song.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so, the ending especially plays like a music video.
Mm-hmm.
Like the rest of the movie totally plays like a music group, but the ending really stands out in that kind of thing.
Well, it's like, yeah, it's like, there are certain parts of the movie that are stronger in the music video thing. All the montages, where he's like, you know, he talks about the flying back and forth and those kind of things, like, that's definitely really strong. And then, yeah, the ending is like that, that's the action, the rock music video, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Triumphant. Kind of climax there.
Right.
No, I don't know. And I'm sorry, I'm still kind of marveling at how perfect that ending is. Even though I knew that the twist was coming, it was still so well done.
That, you know, what he says of the, you know, we have just lost cabin pressure.
Yeah.
Like, that's such, that's what you're feeling. It's like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's great.
It's really a beautiful thing.
There's so many good lines. So much of the movie is quotable. One of the things that's like, I know there's no practical application to use this in the real world, but I would just love to say to someone, "Candy Stripe a cancer ward, it's not my problem." I love when she comes back at him with that. It's such a horrible, like, but funny and like, oh, I love that line. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's so many good ones, though.
The movie is very quotable.
Yes.
It's what we were calling it, Greg and I were talking about the other day, we were calling it the Princess Bride Syndrome, where the movie, because The Princess Bride is a movie where it's really, really quotable, too.
Right, oh yeah.
So.
Yeah, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking about it, like, yeah, Princess Bride, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and this one are, like, some of, like, my favorite movies, and they're all, like, apparently one of the ways to impress me with a film is to have a lot of really quotable lines.
Well, to have really, because the thing about the lines is they're funny.
Uh-huh.
They tend to be comebacks about something.
Right.
And they're smart.
Yes.
So, I don't think there's anything wrong with smart, funny comebacks.
Mm-hmm.
I think that as a society, we could use more of them. I don't know.
Yeah. And I guess if I'm going to talk about quotes, I just have to bring this up because I know I'm not the only person that notices this. There's one of the parts of one of the later speeches that Tyler is giving to the group when they're still Fight Club. And he's walking around and he says, you know, we were all taught that we would grow up to be movie gods and rock stars and we won't. And while that happens, David Fincher, you know, zooms in on Brad Pitt and Jared Leto.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, really?
And yeah, it's you know, a little though, meta.
Yeah, like Leto wasn't, he didn't have, what, 30 Seconds to Mars? Is that the name of his band? Something like that. So, I don't know. He's a musician now. We all know that. But even then, like, he was still coming off of My So-Called Life.
Yeah.
So he was really popular. So it's like you're looking at these two who are, like, considered, you know, by so many females, like, the...
Yeah, 30 Seconds to Mars was formed in 98.
Okay, so he technically already had it at that point, but I don't think they were really famous yet.
Let me find...
I seem to recall them being more of a... This
they were they had become like real early critical success is what it says okay. here. It depends on how much you believe Wikipedia, but
yeah, I know, clearly
on the way up, kind of at right. the time, I bet.
So it's no, like,
that was clearly meant to be.
Yeah, that's a very meta moment right there, of winking at you.
Yeah.
Hard, yeah, and I just want to go fuck you. You are shut up. The rest of us don't get to be, but you did. Oh.
Which is funny. It's also kind of funny to me because not only I love Edward Norton films. I love a lot of the films he's been in. Death to Smoochie. I love that film, like to death. But he is well known for being an asshole.
Backstage or behind the scenes. You mean?
Yeah, he's kind of a diva.
Yeah. The director of American History X wanted to take his name off the film
because
he said he manipulated it so much and turned it into what he wanted it to be. And you could even, if you listen to the commentary that he's on, you can kind of tell, like, he's sitting in a room with David Fincher and Brad Pitt, and he's kind of dominating the conversation. It's a little funny.
Yeah.
It's
not that I don't love the stuff that he's been in, but...
Yeah, it's kind of like, you wouldn't want to work with him. It comes at a price, but he does do really good work.
I'm just saying I'm glad that Fight Club was a one-off.
And not a sequel kind of thing?
That didn't have a sequel?
Well, where would you go, really?
There's nowhere to go.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you can't, you know.
You could, if you tried, you could wedge a story in there, but it would not... You're going to get me going off on sequels now.
Yeah, don't...
Let's not do that, because I have a long, long bitch about sequels. But the story ends where the story ends, and if you want to make a new story, make a new story. Don't continue the same one.
Right. I mean, I think when you've got something like this where it's not the end of the world, but when you've got such a huge game changer like that... You can't really move forward.
It kind of feels like the end of the world. That ending feels kind of apocalyptic in a good way.
It does, yeah.
And that's totally intentional.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, it's really, that's the kind of thing, you just got to let the audience decide if they want to decide where it went in their minds, you know?
Yeah, the only thing you would do with a sequel is ruin the ending of that movie.
Right. Right.
Again, I have very strong feelings on this, and that this is not the time to whip those out.
Yeah.
We can talk about those later, but I have very strong feelings where the story ends where the story ends.
Well, it's kind of, you know, once again, it's like with Watchmen, they keep talking about how in the comics they may be continuing that. It's like, no, you end on nuclear explosions.
Yeah.
You're not continuing. You know, yeah, I think... That's general rule of thumb. If your movie ends with stuff blowing up, don't take it forward.
Yeah.
You're done. You blew up the world. Literally. You
blew up everything.
you're done.
Yeah.
Yeah. But fortunately, I don't think I've ever heard anything about a Fight Club 2, so...
Yeah.
Clearly people understand. And I think that's part of it, because, you know, at the time that it came out, I don't know how much money it made, but it wasn't... A lot of critics didn't like it. They didn't understand it, it seemed like. And it's really only over time that it's kind of built and become the kind of cult classic that it is. Which I think is how it should be with this kind of... It's not the kind of thing that's going to appeal to a mass audience. It's just not.
I think that if it does... That really, really, really good things that say really interesting things can't appeal to a mass audience.
Right.
You can't please everybody with something that's that specific and insightful.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, this movie, like, you know, like we were saying earlier, it's literally challenging the status quo. It's going against those ideas that society tells you, you know, how you should be and what you should want. And
well, yeah, so, it's totally about eliminating the external influence that should not have control over who you are and what you want to do.
Right. So it's going to do one of two things. It's going to make people feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Or
it's going to make them go, fuck yeah!
Exactly, so...
But, again, something that insightful and specific, you can't appeal to a mass audience.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with appealing to a broad audience. There's a lot of pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of things that I like that are meant to appeal to a broad audience. But if it's that targeted and specific, it can't appeal to everybody. It's math.
Right, right.
So I don't have a problem with it not being
universally accepted or...
Yeah, not being... With people not understanding it or being uncomfortable with
right.
it. I don't have a problem with that because that's the way it should be.
And of course, there was also sort of the snap judgment in a lot of ways. When you call something Fight Club, people tended to assume that it was about violence. And it was. It's a very brutal... You know, I mean, there's some tough violence, but it's never glorified.
No.
It's always shown in... It's meant to be kind of horrifying in a way. You know,
yeah,
it definitely gives you revulsion.
It's about breaking things, and
yeah.
Breaking things isn't pretty.
So I think, fortunately, with time, people have sort of come to understand that. And that's kind of why it's sort of grown over time, is that maybe some people were originally like, oh no, I'm not going to watch that. I don't want to watch a bunch of guys beat each other up. And then, you know, once word kind of gets around, it's like, oh no, this is actually a really smart film. There's a lot more to it. And so that's why, like, still not everyone's going to embrace it, but more people definitely have.
It's reaching the audience it is intended for, I guess.
Yes. Yes.
So, no, I agree with you. But, I have feelings on this issue, too, so. I have so many feelings.
Right.
I don't know, we can gush. For a lot longer.
I know, so I'm kind of like, I think we've gotten to the point where we've probably discussed most of the major things.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, we kind of preaching to the choir, probably.
I can't imagine anybody who's going to listen to this hasn't seen, or at least seen Fight Club.
Right.
If you haven't read Fight Club, read Fight Club, because it's excellent.
I mean, it's like, it's, number one, it's one of the quickest reads you'll ever have. So you can't say, oh, I don't have time. Because you really, I mean, trust me, you do. And it's just, yeah, it's if you enjoyed the movie, it's like it, but it's different enough that you're going to enjoy a lot of the differences, too, I think.
It's like when you get hot chocolate and there's a little bit of cinnamon in it. It's good, it's just a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
No, our wrap-up is we loved it, and you should, too.
Yes. And we're purposely not discussing this, because we will go on forever. But I'm going to go ahead, and I'm going to put this question out there for us to discuss in the comments.
That's probably the best way to do this, yes.
Yes. So the question is, why does shooting himself in the side of the face kill Tyler? Did he mean to kill himself completely, or was he doing that on purpose? And then, you know, why does it work? So we're not gonna say what we think right now, but we're gonna ask you that, and please chime in, and we'll have some fun discussion, I think.
Yeah, I think so, because you and I both have many feelings on this as well.
Yes, and even if nobody else comments, we'll probably just have our own little comment war. And if y'all want to hop in, by all means, please do so.
Please do so. We'd enjoy it immensely. So.
Yes. So head on over to the comment page, and we'll talk to you guys later.
Have a good one. Submission to Johnson level.
Living to work to exist to work to exist and age. Intro and outro music for this episode was Hunger is Freedom by Jack Locke. For more information on where to hear the whole song, or to leave us a comment on this episode, please visit us at strangersfromtheinternet.blogspot.com.